What do you think his conclusion was toward the end of his life?
Well, I'll tell you, see, by the time that the girl came in here from Radcliffe, and she said that Harding's, the area in which he could maneuver was over by 54, because once the Supreme Court decision came in, then there was going to be the federal forces against the Confederacy, and there you were lost. You were lost at that point.
Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I think it probably is, because you had to be so much more circumspect after that, and it was pretty awful. And the people that you thought you would be able, this is before 54. And those editorials that Harding wrote right after he got home in 46, 45, well, he was calling on the clergy to do something.
Right.
Only one man came into his office. He was a young Baptist minister, not the First Baptist Church, but one of the others. And the young man said he agreed and he had to get to work and he'd do it. He was gone within 3 months.
Right.
You just can't get ahead of your troops.
Yeah. And then you call on the academics, and they're saying they're gone.
And listen, they know perfectly well that if they move, the state will move against them.
Right.
It was awful. And the power company had the money.
Right.
And the power company was certainly supporting the reaction.
So there was, I think the conclusion that I'm coming to is the right, not the right, but the accurate conclusion, the correct conclusion.
I'm afraid so.
That it couldn't have worked. See, I kept thinking when I started, there was Carter, there was Ralph McGill, there were the smaller papers of Mississippi, I mean, down at Macomb and up in
Lexington
and up in the corner up at
Tupelo,
those papers were very reasonable, progressive papers.
That's exactly what they were, reasonable, progressive.
Not radical, not really... But simply trying to appeal to the reason of well-intentioned people, and it just wasn't there. People listened to James Eastland, they listened to... what was the guy's name who was Speaker of the House?
He was awful.
Yeah.
Rosedale.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Rosedale, Walter Sillars.
Yeah, Walter Sillars.
Oh, they were constantly excoriating us.
Yeah.
Excoriating us.
Yeah.
So, you got the picture.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do the book anyway, so let's talk for a little while.
Okay.
You were born in New Orleans.
Born in New Orleans, brought up in New Orleans, went to girls' schools throughout, went to kindergarten with boys, then from McGee's on, first grade through Newcomb, girls' education. Married Harding, moved to Jackson, Mississippi.
Where did you meet him?
Met him because his sister was at Newcomb, and he was from Hammond, Louisiana, as was she. And she was rushed. Pi Phi and Kappa, and I was rushed Pi Phi and Kappa. And so our freshman year, we had to take physics. And you had to have a physics laboratory made. So we looked at each other, and we knew each other from Rush. So we chose each other. And during the course of the year, she would tell me about her brother,
mm-hmm.
who had graduated from Bowdoin and was now at Columbia, the journalism, Pulitzer School of Journalism. And he was so attractive sounding. So in the summers, we would go to Amite, Louisiana, which is 15 miles north of Hammond, where Harding's family lived. And so I had a birthday, and I telephoned Corrine Carter, and I said, look, come to my birthday party and bring some men. And she said she couldn't come, but she would send her brothers. Well, she sent one brother, who was Harding, and another man, friend, and that's how I met him.
Uh-huh.
And I thought he liked me, but he spent the whole evening on the front porch with my mother. instead of dancing with me. Well, he did come in and dance with me two or three times.
That must have been in about 1930 or thereabouts?
Well, it was earlier than 30 because we were married in 31.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the summer of 28.
I see. Then you all went to Hammond?
No. So then we went to Jackson, Mississippi. And Harding was the Associated Press manager for 5 months. And the big sales tax fight was in the legislature. Everything got very, very hot. And so the sales tax fight, and Greek Rice from Natchez, I think, told the Associated Press that Harding was not getting, for putting out balanced stories. Also, Harding's supervisor, Ralph Wheatley in New Orleans, telephoned or put on the machine, teletype machine, don't file any more stories until I get there. But Ralph Wheatley was known to get drunk, and he didn't come, and he didn't come, and the United Press was filing, the Times-Picayune was filing, the Commercial Appeal was filing, and Harding just couldn't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I'm the AP man, I'm going to get the stories. So he went out and got the stories. Now, in a one-man bureau, in order to get the stories, he had to punch out the story. Do you know what that means?
Mm-hmm.
For the teletype.
Right.
But if he did that, while he was doing that, a committee meeting might be going on. So he went and, at his personal expense, hired a man who knew how to punch, but who had been fired by Wheatley. And so when Wheatley heard that Harding had hired this man and had filed stories when he told him not to, he fired him. Well, that was February or March, February of 32.
Right after you'd married.
5 months, mm-hmm. And there were no jobs. It was the depth of the Depression.
Wow.
So we went on down to his father's house in Hammond, and we were there, and Harding went into New Orleans to see what he could find, but he couldn't find a thing. They were letting everybody off. So we had $300 or $500 from our wedding money. And we'd heard that a young man was starting a mimeograph sheet in competition with the Weekly. And Harding said, well, he wasn't going to get involved with a mimeograph sheet. And we were going to start a daily in competition with the Strongest Weekly in Louisiana, which we did. So we started the Daily Courier in Hammond, Louisiana. And we didn't have a linotype. We didn't have a press. How did we work that? I guess we got a linotype right at the beginning. We got a linotype. But then you would take the copy down to Ponchatoula where it would be, that's not true. How did that work? Maybe we got the press first. We got the press.
Mm-hmm.
So you take the copy to Ponchatoula, they put it all into the big, put it all in the form. And then one morning when we were going over the Illinois Central tracks, the darn thing pied. The whole paper just, always, maybe
came
just
apart.
One page, absolutely.
Gosh.
So then we had to buy a linotype. I don't know how we did any of it.
That seems just impossible now looking back on it.
To start a paper on
nothing. Really?
But it worked. And we were there 4 years, and Harding, we fought here, long tooth and toenail. Mostly because Mr. Carter was against QAnon, and we thought that he was a dictator, and that you had to fight that, which we did. And so we fought and fought, and they just blocked us, and the advertisers were scared to death to advertise with you, but they did. Because
mm-hmm.
Our area was at heart anti-long, and they never got our judicial district. I don't know if they ever got our congressional district or not.
But then it was in 36 when you came to Greenville.
We sold that paper. to some people who had been with the Long administration and paid some money, so they had cash. So we put up half the money, and a group of men and one woman, Mrs. Gamble, put up local money to match what we had.
So you could buy this paper?
No. So we started a paper. They were not interested.
Oh, it was a new paper.
And that's really a problem, to ever start a new paper.
Well, now, there was another rival paper.
There was a paper here.
Merged into it?
There was a paper called the Greenville Democrat Times.
Uh-huh.
So we had the Delta Star. And the Delta Star came out in the morning. And the Greenville Democrat Times came out in the evening. And we ran that for 2 years. And then either we were going to go broke or they were going to go broke. Somebody had to give. So Harding and the young circulation manager got spy glasses and looked at the press run of the Greenville Democrat Times. And as the headline came up on the front page, they counted it. And we found out that we had more circulation than they were claiming. So they confronted them with that, and they gave in. So then we had to buy them, which we did.
What a clever idea, though.
Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
John Gibson and Harding did that. So we took over the, and then we called it the Delta Democrat Times, just based on
right.
The merger. And that was 38. Fall of 38.
Yeah. Going back just for a second to the beginning of the Roosevelt time, did the Hammond paper, did Harding
we
always...
We were for Roosevelt.
Always, right
yep.
from the start?
Right.
With
right.
a lot of enthusiasm?
Oh, for Roosevelt, absolutely. And, of course, Roosevelt was fighting Huey.
Yeah.
So that was another reason for being
right.
for Roosevelt. And at one point, Harding ran for the state legislature simply because nobody else was going to run on the anti-loan ticket. And the Roosevelt people by then had either the PWA or the WPA, and people who needed jobs, they would give them a little work slip, and then they could go and get a job. And so because Harding was anti-loan and pro-Roosevelt, he was given a stack of these work slips that he could give out to people who were going to vote for him. He said, I never could ask a poor soul to vote for me. He needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
How could I ask him to vote mm-hmm. for me? So I don't think that I don't think he did much with the work slips,
mm-hmm.
but and Harding got as many votes as anybody had ever gotten and won. But the poll tax was over, and it was a much larger constituency than it had ever been before, and he was snowed under because
mm.
all the anti-loan people had just been given the ballot.
And they voted then?
Oh, they all voted.
Yeah.
And they did the endless chain.
Or you just keep
you know, the only ballot you have to have is the first ballot. And the man who goes through to vote does not, he gets his ballot, but he doesn't vote it. And he just palms it. And he comes back to the payoff man who gives him the money, or a bottle of whiskey or whatever. Then that blank ballot is marked the way the loan people want it to be marked. Now you go in to vote, and the person sitting there gives you a blank ballot, mm. but you vote the one that's already marked. Then you bring the blank ballot back, and you get
mm-hmm.
you get your pay.
I see.
So that's how they control the election.
1938. In the fall of 1938, in November, there was a big meeting in Birmingham of something called a Southern Conference for Human Welfare.
Probably wouldn't have gone to that.
Do you remember that?
Not a thing about it. We stuck very close to our home knitting.
Mm-hmm.
We figured that we had enough to handle right here. And Harding's position was, that you didn't know all those people. You didn't have time to know all those people, and it could completely ruin what you were trying to do at home.
Mm-hmm.
If people who, you could be identified with something that you weren't identified mm-hmm. with, that you didn't want to be identified with.
Right.
We had our little tightrope that we were walking.
Uh-huh.
Not so much in 38.
But later on.
Because our problems were principally survival.
Yeah.
And as far as race is concerned, I don't remember that we were involved in race.
It didn't
at all.
Really come up for
no,
a long
not
time,
really.
Did it?
No, it didn't.
Yeah, I really think it was into
after
the war years and after the war before anybody really started talking about that very much. Do you know Thomas Sankton?
Tommy, I do.
Is he still living?
I believe, but I don't know where or how or where or what.
How could I find that out, do you think? Who might know?
I don't know. I'd ask in Jackson. Who would I ask?
Yeah.
I don't know who to tell you.
What could you tell me about him?
I can't remember. I just know that we knew Tommy Sankton.
Mm-hmm. He was a Mississippian, was
yes,
he not?
He was.
Or Louisiana?
He was involved with Mississippi.
Yeah.
Well, that's all I really remember.
Mm-hmm. I've been trying to find it. I keep running across articles of his in these old newspapers and magazines.
Right.
I'd like to know if he's still living.
It would
really
be fascinating.
What about some of the people like George McLean in Tupelo and Oliver Emmerich and whatnot?
We saw more of Oliver Emmerich. I don't know why, but you see Tupelo's up there.
Way pretty far up.
And he has a different group of people. Well, so did Emmerich. But Emmerich was more on our road from here to Hammond and New Orleans. And I think that would be one reason that we might have seen more of him, of Oliver.
Could you guess about when Hiding started writing freelancing pieces for magazines and whatnot?
Yes.
The way from the beginning?
Well, after we got to Hammond, and there wasn't any money anywhere. So he wrote one or two articles for the New Republic about Huey P. Long, for which we were paid. He was paid. And then he wrote an article for the Review of Reviews about Huey P. Long. Now that had a magazine that had a good name. And in fact, that magazine, that article, was voted by the National Library Association as the best magazine article of the month. So then you'd have a little poster up at the checkout counter to tell you. And we got paid for that. Well, we were betting on that money to pay for little Hiding at the hospital. But her day was approaching and the money didn't come. So Hiding wrote and said he was worrying about that, but you know, for a day. And so they wrote, they said that that in accordance with their new policy, they gave you like 50 subscriptions to the magazine and 50 packages of Pro-Back razors. I don't think we got a dollar.
Gosh, that's terrible.
And then they went broke.
Yeah.
Everybody was going broke.
Yeah. Was this in when was Hiding?
He was born in 35.
What month?
April.
He's about 2 months older than I am.
Really?
Yeah. I've known him a little bit, but
whenever your paths crossed,
wouldn't say we were really close friends. But he and Pat Darien, I've known off and on down through the
Jackson.
Years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the the Mississippi politicians that you crossed swords with. Beginning with Bilbo and Rankin.
Well, Bilbo was a hot issue, of course. Rankin, we didn't have too much with Rankin.
He was pretty much far removed from
that. That was up there, north Mississippi. But Bilbo would come in here. He would campaign in here. And that summer of, I guess, 46 was a big summer for the Bilbo exploding, where, you know, where Hiding was saying awful things about Bilbo, mm-hmm. and Bilbo was saying awful things about Hiding. And so I never met Bilbo personally, but we went over to hear him in Leland. I remember that big night when he talked and said he was for every Jew from Jesus Christ on down, every goddamn Jew from Jesus Christ on down. Well, Hiding got two or three affidavits that he'd said it, but what he had said was that I'm for every good Jew from Jesus Christ on down. But he said goddamn Jew.
He said that Hiding had said that?
No, Hiding said that Bilbo had said it.
I see.
Bilbo said, I'm for every goddamn Jew from Jesus Christ on down. But Bilbo said that he had said, I'm for every good Jew from mm-hmm. Jesus Christ on down.
Mm-hmm.
Hiding thought he had him hooked with the Baptist then.
Yeah.
Using goddamn.
Yeah.
But couldn't pin it.
No.
Not enough people were willing to testify that they heard it.
But he must have been a terrible person. I mean...
Oh, he was awful, and he was just sexually a goat. And no woman could go into his office safely. There's a list in Washington of which senators you could go in and shut the door, and which you had to leave the door open, and which you had to sit on the other side of the desk from him, and which you had to stand up on the other side. And he was a stand-up on the other side of the desk. Because if you, there was a girl from Hammond who owned property in Mississippi. And her husband was a German. So comes the war. He is going to be put into whatever the concentration camps were. And so she came up to Washington to see what she could do. And she stayed with us. And she had to go see Bilbo because the property, and maybe her husband because of the property, was considered a Mississippian. And he chased her around that desk.
My word.
And she came in. She was absolutely white half an hour after this thing because she said, I don't know what to do because there's my husband. I want to get him out of this thing, but I don't want to do this with Mr. Bilbo.
Yeah, that's
so
terrible.
She didn't, then her husband did come out all right, but Bilbo chased her.
Mm.
So I know that. If it didn't happen to me, it happened to someone who came into my house exhausted. Yeah.
Was that reputation of his widely known?
Widely known. Mm-hmm.
And then there was Senator Eastman.
Well, I don't remember Eastman at all, except that he was terrible and we wrote against him. But I never knew Eastman. I've met Eastman. I don't know what to tell you.
Senator Stennis?
Stennis we knew better, and we knew Stennis because later we knew Stennis better, because his son John was at Princeton with my son Hiding, and they were friends, so we sort of sat with the Stennises at the graduation dinner and that sort of thing.
Did you think of him, terminology is difficult when you discuss these things, but one descriptive approach that a number of people I've talked to have taken and Stennis is a good example to apply it to, would be to say, oh, he was not a racist. He was a very decent man. It was, what he said about race was strictly for his own protection. And they made a distinction between his personal attitudes and his statements, unlike Bilbo or unlike Eastman who felt it deep down in their bones.
But people who had to deal with Eastman, a lot of them preferred dealing with Eastman to Stennis. because as Alfred Eastland told you from the beginning where he stood,
mm-hmm.
whereas Stennis gave you a softened version of
uh-huh.
the thing.
Yeah. But basically they ended up at the same place.
Exactly the same boat.
This name I know nothing about except this person, Clarence Hood.
I know that name.
Was a Democratic loyalist in 48 when the Dixiecrats bolted. He was from Jackson.
That name, I know the name.
Know the name, but nothing more. Okay. What about Percy Green, who was the black journalist in Jackson?
Only read him.
Bill Minor.
Loved him.
Bill's still around, and
yeah,
I hope to see him.
He'd know a lot.
Yeah, he's probably going to be a good source
mm-hmm.
for me. What about McGill?
We Potting and Ralph McGill and the man in Little Rock.
Harry Ashmore.
Those three used to get on the phone. We didn't have conference calls, but one would call the other
mm-hmm.
and then they would discuss the same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Did you think of their views, those three men's views, as being
very
closely coinciding?
Very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar.
They
gave each other support.
Yeah. Once in summer of 48, Hodding and Harry Ashmore went up east to do a series of radio and public appearances. Do you recall
uh-huh.
that?
Mm-hmm.
And it was curious reading about that because I think of them in the context of here, where they would fight the battles against all kinds of reactionary people. But when they were there, or when they wrote for the Saturday Evening Post or the Colliers or whatnot, they were really trying to explain and even defend the South against
Absolutely.
the unreasonable and ignorant
Absolutely.
Views of non-Southerners.
Absolutely.
And that's a real tightrope, isn't it?
It was a real tightrope. And it finally, you know, was a rope around their necks.
Yeah.
Because if they went too far, the rope got pulled.
Yeah.
You see, they never wanted to be anything but loyal sons of the South.
Yeah.
But the damn loyal, the South wasn't going to be what they wanted the South to be.
Mm-hmm.
So they just struggled to try to make the South be what they wanted it to be.
Uh-huh.
And the South wouldn't come along.
Yeah.
It really took the Voting Rights Act.
Well, you're anticipating one of my questions, which...
Yeah, well, do your line.
No, that's fine. You know, many times I've read in his speeches in magazine pieces and books statements to the effect that if people would just
leave us alone,
we can work this out. And
that's
he really
he
believed
hoped.
That,
he
didn't
hoped
he?
Hoped it. He really hoped it. Faith, hope, and charity.
Yeah.
And the greatest of these is charity for all those people who weren't paying any attention.
Yeah. Looking back on it now, do you think the South ever would have done it without the force
no.
of federal
no.
law and the courts?
No, no, no.
And
no.
the black protest movement
no,
and all the rest?
No, you had to have it. You had to have it.
Do you think that Hodding felt that too by the
At
time?
At the end. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. You see, eventually you just saw that it was, they weren't going to come along.
Yeah.
Now, I don't remember his ever sitting up and saying any such thing. Now, you just remember that Hodding was not well from 64 on.
So really, he wasn't able to really
he
look at...
He wasn't able to really throw...
My God, think at all that's happened since 64.
Absolutely.
So we have a perspective that's much longer than...
Absolutely.
...than he had.
You see, and young Hodding was taken over by them, which was so lucky for us.
Yeah.
In 64, Hodding lost the reading vision. He couldn't read from then on.
Yeah.
And also Tommy Carter died.
Yeah.
And the two things happened within a week. And that was the end. He
uh-huh.
had killed him. Well, he lived. He did
yeah.
a lot of things. He spoke.
Yeah.
He wrote several books.
Right.
But...
He was a different...
He was very different.
Yeah. What? Tell me about his eye injury. How did that happen?
Well, I'm trying to think which eye, the right eye, I think it was, that down at Camp Landing on the night maneuvers, he did something to it. So after that, he had partial vision, a peripheral vision in his right eye. And then when he had the retinal detachment, it was in his left eye.
Oh, gosh.
And he had no reading vision with the right. Now he has a retinal detachment, no reading vision at all. Well, so that was that.
Yeah. And so by when, about 64?
64, April.
He was not able to read?
Uh-uh.
Gosh.
The only thing that saved his sanity was that he was supposed to be, he had an article to do for a book called, it was about small towns in America, but it's still alive. This one was about Holly Springs. And we had gone over and done all the research. We had all the material. And we'd gotten the advance. But that was not as important as the fact that the deadline arrived. And so they telephoned and said, we have got to have that piece. We have got to have it. Well, it gave Harding something else to do. And I really think it saved his sanity. Mm. I think he would have jumped into the Mississippi River if it hadn't been for that.
Wow. That had to have been really tough. Or a writer not to be able to see.
Not to be able to see.
It's just the worst.
Terrible. I guess it would be terrible for a carpenter.
Yeah.
Or a lawyer. No, doctor. Anybody.
Yeah.
But terrible.
Hmm. Also, another thing that he talked about a lot up and before Brown was that if the South was going to have separate but equal,
it had to make
the equal separate.
Absolutely.
Make the separate truly equal.
We couldn't believe it. This town was paying, spending five times as much on the education of a white child as it was on the education of a black child. That was just the accepted standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over once and did a feature on a woman who had 75 children in her classroom. Well, how can you teach with 75 children in the class? They weren't all there every day. No air conditioning. The kids were sitting in the windows and on the floor. They didn't even have chairs for them all if they all came.
Right.
And so the story came out in the paper, and I didn't know this until long afterwards. She never was able to have a job with the Greenville School Board after that.
Because of the story?
Because she had cooperated.
My gosh.
So she was teaching up in the county schools. An able woman.
Yeah. Did you ever know Lillian Smith?
No. And her book, Strange Fruit, came out at the same time as Harding's Winds of Fear. And in England, Winds of Fear beat Strange Fruit.
Mm-hmm.
She was ahead of our thinking considerably.
I kind of look at her now as being almost a prophet in a way.
She was.
She believed and said early in the 40s that the real problem here was segregation, and if we didn't deal with segregation, we never would be able to work the other problems out. And now we can look at that and see that that was true. But back then, I mean, you had to be crazy to make a statement like that. I think one reason she was able to do it was that she really didn't have an institutional tie that restrained her in any way.
Right.
I mean, even if you own a newspaper, you don't want to toss it in the Mississippi River.
You don't own it.
That's right.
The public owns it.
If people won't buy the papers or buy advertising, you're over. Yeah. So she was...
And she was able to put all of her energy into that statement.
Yeah.
But we also were putting out a paper where you had to talk about the fire hazard in the...
Right.
This and the...
All the other things.
Yeah, and what are you going to do about syphilis?
Right. So,
you know?
I don't I don't mention her to suggest that she was any more courageous at all. It was just that her position was different.
It was very different.
But she was a courageous woman. She was very outspoken and
very good.
I thought that was kind of interesting. Can you think of anybody that you all have known from that period of the 30s and 40s, anybody, white or black, Southern, who took a position on the racial thing similar to that?
You mean 30s and 40s?
Uh-huh.
Forget the 30s.
Prior to Brown, just forget the 30s.
Let's go right up to 54.
Yeah, up prior to 54. Mm-hmm. Can you think of anybody that you all knew who you thought was really...
Well, they were in the East. Lots of people in the East in the cocktail circuit.
But nobody down here.
I'm trying to think who could have been down here. I'm sure they existed, and I'm sure my brain ought to give me an answer to that.
Well, see, I guess I'm not really sure they did. I guess I'm thinking that almost everybody had to pull their punches on this a little bit. Some more than others, but... Now, the exceptions that I have found are black, whose circumstances were all different. They were, after all, the oppressed people in that circumstance. And yet, nobody heard them, you know.
Oh, no.
It made absolutely no... I read a thing, and I've been over it reading newspapers and microfilm, and Thurgood Marshall came to Mound Bayou in April of 54, before Brown, and made a speech.
What was Brown, May?
Brown was in May.
First Monday.
Uh-huh. He made a speech to a large gathering at Mound Bayou in which he said, "We're going to sue Ole Miss to open up Ole Miss. They're not going to get to be segregated any longer up there." And I mean, he just hammered away at it. And well, nobody white is going to, can't do that, you see. It just is not possible. And my feeling coming into all this was, well, there were lots of people, you know, there were Carters and McGills and Ashmores and even some politicians like Ellis Arnold and Jim Folsom and whatnot. But when I go back and look at what they were actually saying and actually doing, nobody was saying, look, the problem here is segregation. We've got to get rid of the problem first. I mean, you just
nobody
couldn't. It was an unthinkable thought.
No, and what you didn't dare say that.
Right.
What you did was that you hammered away. You chiseled around the edge.
On the separate but equal thing
and
all of the others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You chiseled around eating little bites out of it, which you hoped would lead to equality before the law and equal education and the vote, but you didn't want to attack segregation
right.
as such.
Yeah.
Because then they would say, along with Bilbo, that you're for mongrelization of the
right.
race.
Yeah.
And when you get into a sex issue,
yeah.
look at the abortion thing
yeah,
right now.
Right. We're just totally...
It's going to split the United States.
We're totally immobilized by the emotionalism
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been a dangerous thing, too. You know, beyond the emotionalism, I think it would have been physically dangerous for people to really be that outspoken.
You mean that mobs would get you?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, I think they would have lynched you.
I think
in
it could easily
situations.
Have happened, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not in Greenville, but
plenty of other
backwater
places.
Country towns.
Yeah. Because
the very thought that you might be for segregation, integration,
mm-hmm.
was enough to
yeah, that was enough
make
to set people
furious.
Wild.
But who are these people? These people that we're talking about were the old reactionary leadership.
Yeah, that's right.
And we kept hoping that these other people would come up somehow and have other ideas and speak up for things. Maybe not for integration, but for speak more loudly on the nibbling side, but they wouldn't even do that.
What about the Mississippi governors of this period? there was a Governor White, first of all, was in office when this...
Well, I don't think he had, we don't think we were in the race on him, really.
He was in office when Brown came down.
Really?
Uh-huh, in 54.
Well, then he's bound to have had a good, strong statement against it.
Compared to Eastland, he sounded right reasonable.
Did he?
Mm-hmm. He said, we ought not to make rash statements, we ought to think about this. Of course, his thoughts didn't get him very far, but at least
he... I didn't know. That's good.
It was a little bit. What about James Coleman? This was a little later,
well, we
of course.
Thought he was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
We thought he was willing to think of things.
Yeah. I spoke to him yesterday. Had a really a very interesting conversation with him for about an hour
Is
and a half.
Is he in Jackson?
He's at Ackerman.
His old home.
His old home. And I enjoyed the conversation very much. He's a great raconteur. And he talks pretty reasonably. A lot more.
You know,
now.
Earl Johnson has that book coming out.
Uh-huh.
You know about
I heard
book.
About that.
Right. And Young Harding said it was a good book.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people, I've even ordered it. Mm-hmm. I never would have thought I would do such a thing.
Yeah.
But I think he's it'd be interesting to see what he had to say on his side of
mm-hmm.
yeah. his history, his memories
right.
of what was happening during those days.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I went down and talked to Anita Blackwell down at Mineville, and she's the gal who, black woman now, the mayor of Mineville, who led the group that went in and took one of the buildings at the Greenville Air Base to make it to dramatize the fact that the people were being put off of the plantations and had no place to go.
What year was that, do you know?
About 62, probably.
Yeah,
later than what you're after.
The other governor that I wanted to ask you about is Fielding Wright.
He was a lawyer.
He was the guy who in 48 went on the Dixiecrat ticket with Strom Thurmond. Yeah.
Right. Now he was an intransigent.
They almost succeeded in taking Mississippi out of the Democratic Party,
sure.
didn't they?
Sure.
One of the things that James Coleman said yesterday was if there is any ironclad rule in politics, it is you don't desert your party. And it was that position that made a moderate out of him rather than a reactionary like Wright.
Uh-huh.
He just said, under no circumstance, I'll make a flat statement,
you
I would never leave my party over an ideological or other issue. And so he, by his explanation, he was able to stand on that position and kind of be a cut above the
yellow
whole
dog Democrat.
Yeah, right. Instead of letting it swing on race or something else, he would just say, it's my
the
party.
Yeah. The party.
But Wright and the others.
The thing is that I'm not too good a person to interview on this because I was running a house, I was working on the paper, and I was running ladies' clubs.
Yeah.
So
you,
I was
you
in
had
touch
your hands full with a lot of
without
other
keeping up entirely, except at dinner
mm-hmm.
and in the evening hearing the talk.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Ms. Carter. Again, with the advantage of hindsight,
mm-hmm.
looking back to those years, could you give me an idea of about when, in terms of a year, about when you think that you and your husband would have reached the conclusion that segregation had to go? Would it have been when Brown came down or before Brown?
It couldn't have been before Brown.
Even up to Brown, you were still...
Harding never permitted himself to think of himself as an integrationist. And there was a book that he wrote, and I can't remember whether it was First Person Rural, and they sent us copies of the book ahead of publication, before they were all distributed, and on it it had the book jacket, and the book jacket said that Harding Carter was the foremost integrationist in the South. Harding got on the phone and phoned the publisher, or his agent, his publisher, And he said, look, if that, if you let that stand, I'm going to sue you for everything that you've got.
Wow.
Because I'm not an integrationist. If you admitted you were an integrationist, everything we had in the world was gone.
Yeah.
So they had to call in all those books with the book jackets and change the book jackets.
And that was after 54,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Now, I can't be sure which book it was or what date. But I'm sure it was after 54. Well, we could easily check that.
Yeah. You think it was first person rule?
I think it was, but I'm not positive.
By the end of his life, do you think he would have considered himself an integrationist?
You mean secretly? Don't know the answer to that. If I did, I'm not sure I would tell you.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it would be fair. We never discussed that. And I don't think it would be fair for me to say, put him in a position maybe he was not in. And it would have implied that from 64 to 72 when he died, that he had made this step. And I don't know if he had.
Yeah. Well, let me ask it a different way. If he could see what has happened here, do you think he'd be pleased or not?
I think he would be thrilled.
You do?
Yes, because this is the way it had to go.
Yeah.
This country has to be one, and people have to be one.
Yeah. That's an